Hi, and welcome to HeyOA, a podcast brought to you by ORSI, the Osteoarthritis Research Society International. I'm Carrie Costello, and our guest this month is Professor Peter Chung from Melbourne, Australia. Professor Chung is a Sir Hugh Devine Chair of Surgery, Head of the Department of Surgery for the University of Melbourne at St. Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne, and Director of Orthopedics at St. Vincent's. His work primarily focuses on three areas that underpin his clinical programs, namely studying the molecular regulation of bone tumors, advanced limb reconstruction, and improving outcomes of arthritis surgery. His research has been supported by the Australian National Health and Medical Research Council, the Australian Research Council, the Royal Australian College of Surgeons, the Australian Orthopaedic Association, and Cancer Australia, along with many other private industry funders. Today I will be talking to him about his role as the lead chief investigator for the Center of Research Excellence in Total Joint Replacement, also known as OPIS. This is a center built around multidisciplinary clinical research involved with optimizing outcomes, equity, cost-effectiveness, and patient selection for total joint replacement and treatment of late-stage osteoarthritis. Professor Chung is also a custodian of the St. Vincent's Melbourne Arthroplasty Outcomes, or SMART, registry that contains 11,000 cases of hip and knee joint replacement surgeries collected since 1998. From 2006, the group began taking patient outcome measures to feed into the registry, which has resulted in the collection of more than 100,000 patient survey records, making it a rich source of data for research and publications. And without further ado, we'll welcome Professor Chung. Hello, Peter. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today.
Hi, Carrie. How are you? All the way from Australia here?
Yeah, welcome. I'm excited to talk to you both about your own research, but also about this big collaborative effort that you're a part of called OPIS. Can you tell us a little bit about what OPIS is all about?
Yeah, so OPIS is actually a play on words. It means a body of work, and it is a body of work we've been doing here in Melbourne over the last decade or so, and it is about researching how we would treat people with very significant, severe, and painful osteoarthritis. So in case you or the listeners aren't too familiar, osteoarthritis is a condition of joints which is characterized by pain, stiffness, and inability to move properly. And it is because the cartilage lining of the joints, which gives it its movement, starts to fail and it gets rough and it seizes up. And it's a progressive thing, getting worse, both symptomatically and also with the loss of function. So I've been seeing how we can best treat that using joint replacement surgery. Recognizing that joint replacement surgery isn't for everyone, we've also looked at different ways we can treat people who perhaps are not fit for surgery or who we believe will not respond as well to surgery. And finally, for those who we feel no matter what we do, surgery might be too dangerous for them. So getting alternatives for these people are also quite important. One of the things that we've combined with our research is also understanding how we can deliver it in the most efficient way. And I think efficiency is something that is important no matter which part of the world you are in, because we all want timely care. Knowing how to get time as well as resources is another very important aspect of treatment, which we are looking into. Mm-hmm. So that forms, I guess, the kernel of the work that we're doing. And our collaborations do extend across the globe to involve Europe, United Kingdom, North America, Asia. And being a global problem, it's only right that we have global partnerships helping us solve many of these problems.
It's my understanding that one of the main funders for your project is the Australian government because they're interested in informing best practices for healthcare. Can you explain a little bit about how that works? What's the role of the funding source?
Yeah, so the National Health and Medical Research Council, or the NHMRC, is very similar to the Cancer Research Councils, or the NIH in the United States, where it recognizes what the health priorities are for the nation, and it apportions funding for research around that. Now, musculoskeletal disorders, of which osteoarthritis is part of, is of the major leading causes of disability in our part of the world, as well as other parts of first world countries. And because of that, funding needs to follow to help come up with solutions of how you might treat this in a way that brings up the best care for patients, the best outcomes, as well as cost effectiveness. So the NHMRC has provided us with funding in the form of an award called the Center for Research Excellence, which is a competitive granting system where perhaps a handful of groups around Australia each year will be lucky enough to be recipients of this award, and we were that in 2016. So that brings with it a goodly sum of money that allows us to develop the framework in which we can conduct our various branches of research, whether it's in surgery or logistics or alternative options for care. One of the areas that we're particularly interested in, of course, is in decision-making, that is by the patient as well as the surgeon, and how they need to align so that the various expectations are met and the best outcomes follow in terms of satisfaction.
Yeah, so I saw you were one of the principal, or you are the principal investigator for one of those topic areas that was focused on assessing a model of appropriateness for total joint replacement. So what factors do you use to identify or classify patients when you're looking at appropriateness?
Yeah, so appropriateness is really important. Some people find it a very touchy subject, but the reality is some patients, when you treat them, are going to turn out with very good outcomes. Others are going to turn out with very bad outcomes. And knowing which of these two groups is a big way of assessing risk to patients, and also making sure that the best outcomes are received by those who are undergoing surgery. So the way we look at appropriateness has been to review our experiences over the last decade and a half with all the patients we've operated on, and find out what are the factors that they have which would make them responders to joint replacement or not. So, for example, we look at the x-rays of their joints to see how severe the joint arthritis was before surgery, or we look at their weight, so-called BMI, basal metabolic index, which is a reflection of overweightness or obesity and how that relates to outcomes. We look at their mental health status, for example. So we have found a series of factors or indicators, we call them, that when you put them together and apply them to patients, we get a reading on an index as to how likely they are not to respond to joint replacement. And if we can identify groups of patients who are non-responders, then those are the groups we should be focusing on to look for alternatives. On the other hand, if some of these people in the non-responder groups are only there because of factors that we may be able to influence and improve, then we gather them to the side and say, well, how can we optimize things for you? How can we make you better? How can we reduce risks for you so that you move from being the group in the red light zone to the group in the green light zone? You know, we call it the red, green, amber system, just like traffic lights. Mm-hmm. Green, if you get a green, means, you know, you go ahead and have your surgery. We know you're going to do well. If you're the red, well, you've got to stop and we've got to think about how we make it better. And if you're in the amber zone, we've got to look at ways of how we can really optimize things for you so that we reduce risk and move you across into the group. So while I do lead the entire research program, the area of particular interest for me is in appropriateness. And so this is the area that I think needs a lot of attention. And I think, you know, clinicians, GPs, surgeons, rheumatologists, physiatrists have always been, I guess, forced in many ways to default to what they do, not recognizing that there are perhaps alternatives of how we might care for patients. So surgeons might just decide, well, I need to operate on you because I don't know what else there is to do. And secondly, we treat people all the same. We don't try and differentiate within the group with bad arthritis whether they can have surgery or not. And I think knowing this will reduce risks to patients. It will reduce the harm that we're exposing them to, and it will also reduce the likelihood of a non-response. And a non-response, that means even in the best surgeries, if the patient doesn't feel any better, they might as well have not had the surgery or they might as well have had a complication from the surgery. It's that bad. So we're trying to remove all the bad things that happen and really isolate the good things that we know joint replacement can bring. So that's really the concept of appropriateness of what we do.
That's pretty neat. I know I was reading a bunch of papers earlier today looking at appropriateness of joint replacement or who should have joint replacements. And when you're either looking at the factors and trying to say, okay, of these people, who did we send to have a joint replacement? Or the other way around, saying, okay, we sent these people for joint replacement, what was similar between them? And they don't seem to always match up well. And we still have, you know, up to 20% of people that are dissatisfied after having a knee replacement, in addition to the other complications you mentioned. So I think that's definitely an interesting area of study.
Yeah, and I think because, you know, we one of the challenges of medicine in the 21st century, I guess, is just making sure we are responsible about where we direct resources. We can't afford to waste things. I mean, you know, some time ago, a group reviewed the cost of providing health and came up with a figure of 20 to 30% of health cost is from wastage and complications. And that means, you know, one third of people are missing out because of wastage and complications. So we really have to be very careful these days. And what is also driving the urgency to come up with strategies to be careful is because, ironically, as we're getting healthier, we're living longer, and conditions like arthritis, which is a degenerative condition, are coming more and more to the fore. And these are taking a much more prominent place in the causes of disability in our community. So the demand will rise, and joint replacement, the need for it will increase more and more and more. So we have to be very careful that we just don't simply dole it out all the time, but we're selective about who should get it so that the best results always follow, or at least the best as we can.
And how does healthcare work in Australia? Is it more similar to Canada where it's a government-funded system, or is it more similar to the US where individuals are purchasing their own insurance?
Well, it's really a hybrid of the two. Since the mid-70s, we've had what's called a universal healthcare system where the government, through all the public hospitals, provides care for every single person in the nation. Whoever you are, you can go into any hospital and you will receive the best possible care. There are some people, however, who wish to go into the private system because they don't want to wait, because the waiting lists are long, as will be in any country where there's a universal healthcare system. There are long waiting lists and there are limitations of when care can actually be provided. In the private system, on the other hand, this is less so of a case, although we still have to be very responsible about how we spend money. Patients can have a choice of who they are treated by. They can have a choice of where they want to go. They can have a choice as to when they want to be treated, because a lot of private health funds goes into the treatment of elective care, elective surgery or elective medical care. So that's, you know, we have a hybrid of both. And I think about one third of Australia is covered by private health care, and two thirds seek access through the public health system.
I would imagine that the results of your research, though, would still be translatable to other countries with different systems as well, even though if somebody different might be paying, somebody's always paying. So if you're giving better health care and you're saving whoever's paying for that health care money, then that's going to be a good thing, both for the healthcare system and for the individual patient.
Yeah, absolutely. I have two aspects to think about here. Efficiency and cost effectiveness are two things that apply right around the globe. It may be more or less depending on which society you look at, but I think everyone is always careful about where the dollar goes. So, you know, one has to be cost conscious. And also, whenever you do things, there's a waiting period. So efficiency, how well we do things, how quickly and how timely, becomes important as well. So the work that we do looking at that will be applicable across the globe. The other thing also, which is really important, is the fact that patients don't differ. They still feel pain. They still feel the they still feel pain. They still feel the sorts of dysfunction. And because of that, you know, what we find in Australia that helps patients feel better after surgery would be equally as important, because the treatment is more or less the same, whether it's in Canada, United States, UK, continental Europe. So, you know, those factors are absolutely translatable and needs to be if our work is to have the sort of impact we would like it to have.
I saw that there's also another area of research looking at optimizing patient care following joint replacement. So it seems like you guys are addressing all of the different factors of appropriateness for joint replacement.
Yeah, so we're trying to look at the entire spectrum, the whole patient journey, as it were. And, you know, to talk about the patient journey, it's really important to appreciate that you go from point A to point B, but that might be a straight line, it might be circuitous. One has to recognize that the patient's journey is being buffeted on all sides by a whole bunch of different variables like cost, work practices, whether the hospital's big enough for the surgery, whether the hospital has what you need for the surgery or not. So it's constantly being buffeted. And even after surgery, it's being buffeted by whether there's a complication or not, whether you're getting the right physical therapy, whether the pain control is there. So we are very interested to make sure that when we talk about outcomes, it's not about whether they successfully have the surgery, but the entire patient experience, because each step of the patient's journey influences other parts of the journey. And so it's really important to integrate the system as much as is possible. So in terms of the rehabilitation, it's important for us to get the most out of their joint replacements by finding the best types of exercises for them, which are safest, knowing when to introduce them. We also need to know what should we do during surgery itself to make that transition across the rehabilitation as effective as possible. And should patients be going home more often and getting physical therapists coming out to them rather than trying to go to a center that provides physical therapy? At the end of the day, though, I guess what we're hoping for is the patient not only feels good, but their joint functions the way it should, which is why we have a very multidisciplinary approach with pain control, physical therapists, even psychology into how we manage pain and action afterwards.
So with all of these different factors going into this and potentially different sites or surgeons or different postoperative teams or postoperative care, do you need to account for differences between these different sites or different surgeons, or do you try to standardize that in your research?
Well, what we're looking at is actually whole of system redesign. What we're identifying is that there are similar checkpoints, no matter which part of the world and nation you come from, that need to be considered. For example, the obvious ones at the start are the referral from the general practitioner. What does the general practitioner have to do? Secondly, what happens in an outpatient setting in a hospital? Thirdly, how do patients get managed on waiting lists? Other things include how is surgery actually conducted on the day of surgery and what resources and personnel are required. And then finally, after that, where do you send patients and how long do they stay in? Those are very defined checkpoints that we see across the globe of equal importance. Now, recognizing that, the prioritization of these may be different depending on what systems exist. So, for example, in the United States, where they have, you know, patients staying in for only 2 days after joint replacement surgery, that is completely different than in Australia, where they might stay in for 4 to 7 days. And so that brings a completely different demand of care and resource utilization. And we will try and benchmark across the globe about what people are doing differently to try and optimize for different environments, as it were. But our research is trying to identify as far as is possible the important areas along the journey and how one might begin to regulate these, I guess, and alter them in favor of the patient.
According to your newsletter, it looks like Opus launched just over a year ago. Is that correct?
Yes.
So has anything changed since then? Progress have you been able to make towards your goals so far?
Well, we've had a really exciting start. I guess because the team behind Opus had been around for a while, we had prepared where we wanted to go, what we needed to do, and the sorts of capacity we needed to build. And very, very quickly, was able to employ infrastructure staff into position. We're able to appoint postdoctoral researchers who will help guide the different themes of research along on a day-to-day basis, and then to fill the research positions with PhDs, for example, PhD students who can use this as the meat in their career development, as it were. Each of the different themes, and there are four main themes. One is about appropriateness, another one about decision-making, the third one about alternatives of care, and the final one about the logistics of how you deliver care. Each of us now have these people in place and have been able to advance elements of research within that. In addition to that, the work coming out of even the start of Opus has allowed us to generate other grants. For example, we recently also got a very large partnership grant with other universities around Australia, looking at how we could test the appropriateness tool, for example. So even after only a year, we really have hit our stride very well with appointments, with getting the groups to meet and talk about and plan precisely the sort of research that needs to be conducted and make way, headway along it, as well as some early wins in terms of grants that we've put in and papers that we've written. So it's really been a very productive and exciting time, and it's certainly most satisfying for all the members of our research teams.
So when I had looked at the website earlier when I was doing research, it did look like there were still a few opportunities listed for people who are interested in joining the team. I think it might have been some of the PhD student positions. Is that still somewhere that people could go to look if they were interested in those opportunities?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we are very interested in doing is building capacity for the future leaders in osteoarthritis research. And they've got to start somewhere. And so we provide opportunities for people wanting to do PhDs with us and also postdoctoral positions with us. Of course, funding is the key issue here. And for people who want to do work with us, they either find ways of getting scholarships and funding from their home institutions and then they work with us. Or alternately, they vie for some of the scholarship grant positions that Opus actually provides from time to time. What we do have, though, is a lot of material that can be worked on. And by bringing in PhDs, we, particularly from different institutions, what we're doing is we're building bridges between our institution and their home institutions, which can only be a good thing as it extends the network for osteoarthritis care and research around the world. So we thoroughly welcome any interest that people might show, and I direct them towards our website to be in contact with us.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Peter. It's been really nice talking to you, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what is to come from Opus in the future.
Kerry, it's been an absolute delight for me to chat with you, and I look forward to maintaining the links as well as having any interest shown in our direction, receiving that warmly and reciprocating.
Another big thanks to Professor Chung for joining me today and sharing some of the work that Opus is doing. You can find out more about their research on the Opus website at medicine.unimelb.edu.au/surgery/Opus, or stay even more up to date by following them on Twitter and Facebook using the @OpusUniMelb handle. That's @OPUSUNIMELB. As always, you can find more information about OA research on ORSI's website at oarsi.org, and conference registration for the 2018 World Congress on Osteoarthritis in Liverpool is now open. You can find the links to the conference website from orsi.org. Remember to follow @HeyOAPodcast on Twitter for updates and discussion about new and upcoming episodes. We also would like to start featuring listener mail, so feel free to interact with us either on Twitter or by email at heyoapodcast@gmail.com if you have any comments, questions, or corrections regarding any episodes of HeyOA. And last, please consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a rating or review in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you're listening. As always, thanks to Hakeem Karood for our theme song. Thanks for listening to HeyOA.